You're listening to Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. This is the second part of a two-part episode featuring Dr. Dominic Della Sala. Dr. Della Sala is currently a Senior Conservation Science Associate at the Conservation Biology Institute. He has authored over 300 peer-reviewed papers and 9 award-winning books on forests, climate change, and endangered species. He has given numerous plenary and keynote talks, including for the United Nations. His recent work focuses on the Northern Rockies and the unprecedented convergence of climate change, inappropriate wildfire and forest management, and humanity's cumulative ecological footprint that is transforming the integrity of the bioregion. Dr. Della Sala came to Bozeman for a speakership hosted by the Gallatin Wildlife Association on Friday, September 12th. His visit comes at a time when southwest Montana, like so many other regions, faces mounting ecological pressure in response to human-caused climate change amplified by misguided legislation. The day after Dr. Della Sala's presentation, he sat down with me and Clint Nagel, president of the Gallatin Wildlife Association, at the Nature Preserve outside of Story Mill Park. How does the commercial value in logging influence its application as a strategy for management?
Well, it costs money to thin a forest. It's not a cheap thing. Depending on where you are, access problems, etc., it could be anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000 an acre. And while Congress is pretty much giving the agencies a blank check to go into the national forest and do all kinds of logging, there are limits on how much is available to spend in their so-called active management projects. It's kind of a broad term that involves a lot of different ways to interact with the landscape. The way the federal agencies have used it is mostly some form of logging, whether it's thinning big trees, thinning small trees, post-fire logging, insect control, pest control, pathogen control. That's how they generally look at active management. And there are a lot of other ways you can actively manage an ecosystem in a restorative way that don't involve taking out big trees and putting in roads. But when the type of active management that they're doing is actually going to make the system a lot more prone and a lot less resilient to fire. The way they try to pencil it out is they look for the big trees. And those are the commercial logs, and that helps to sweeten the pot, so to speak, to do the kinds of logging that is happening in these forests. They're not really aiming at the small trees as much as they are the commercial value that is coming from the large trees that are the most fire resistant in a forest stand are the ones that have the highest commercial value and the ones that are often coming out in these thinning operations.
So what place does thinning play in wildfire management?
Any kind of fuel reduction should be as close to the structure as possible. We have really strong evidence that the best way to prepare communities for wildfires spilling over into the urban area is point of ignition at the structure. Clear surrounding vegetation within about a 50 to 100 foot radius around the structure, harden the structure itself, metal roofs, composite roofs, screening on the vents, screening on the gutters, no flammables around the structure itself, no wood on the outside of the house, then you got a really good chance of even if a fire passes through your community, it's going to skip over your house. Your house is not going to be the fuel. But everybody needs to do it because if your neighbor hasn't done it, then that is then the catalyst for a domino effect of all the houses burning up. Because one or two people in the whole community didn't properly plan, it could have a cascading effect on the whole community. That's where we need to be doing the majority of the management.
Here in Bozeman and the Gallatin County, one of the problems are people building in the wild and urban interface. And a lot of that, I suppose, is because of the county allowing them to do that. How do we, as NGO, local NGO, convince county organizers or county commissioners to stop that practice?
I just gotta, it's a real difficult one because the county governments get taxable revenue off of development, and development brings jobs. It helps the community prosper. So there's a lot of benefits to it. The problem is that we're not looking at the cost enough. And the costs are, most of the wildfire suppression dollars are to prevent wildfires from spilling into communities that should not have been built there in the first place. And a lot of county government agencies don't like zoning restrictions on land development. And that's part of the problem. So we are now living in the American West in the imperfect storm, I call it. You have an increase in fire activity because of the way we're dumping emissions into the atmosphere. You have all this logging in the wildlands that is priming the fire pump. And you have sprawl. And all of that has come together over the last several decades, at least since World War II, to create this imperfect storm. You've got to solve all of these issues together comprehensively. We call those the root causes. So the root causes of the fire problem are homes built in the wrong places because of lack of zoning, logging in the wildlands that is only going to make it worse, and emissions in the atmosphere. It's a global problem that everybody needs to be involved in at the local level, providing a solution. Otherwise, we're just complicit to this runaway climate crisis that is only going to make it worse for communities that are living in these areas that are experiencing fire in the American West. If I go to the southeast, it's hurricanes. If I go along the coast, it's sea level rise. In island communities, it's sea level rise. And it's tornadoes and all these different factors that are now impacting human civilization. We only make it worse by treating the atmosphere as a dumping ground for greenhouse gas emissions. So we got to address this issue at a community level, at a government level, at an international level that deals with the root causes.
Given the broader drivers for wildfires and the trajectory we are currently on in relation to climate change, and you've mentioned the fighting fires at the point of ignition or preventing fires at the point of the ignition is a major strategy in this, but how else can communities work to become more resilient as the threat grows?
If you live in an area that experiences fire, there are challenges to living in that area. The community that I live in Southern Oregon, I've lived there for almost 30 years. And so when I first moved there in the 1990s, we didn't have heat domes. We didn't have fires and smoke every year. Now, heat domes and fires and smoke every year are more the new abnormal. And so we have got to make adjustments to that. We've got to adapt as a society, as a community, to the events that we are triggering. And the way we have to do that is we have to fall in love again with our wild areas, because that's going to help us plan for the climate crisis that we're in, the clean water that we get, the clean air that we get, the recreation, the wildlife, fisheries benefits are coming from the wildest places. We're going to need those more than ever. And we're also going to need to adapt to the situation that's out of our hands right now. We've started this. There's inertia in the atmosphere. We can slow it down by getting off of fossil fuels, but we can't stop it right now. And so we've got to prepare for it by being resilient communities, by hardening our structures, defensible space, smoke shelters, ingress, egress routes for escaping from the potential for a wildfire, air filtration systems, health systems that are ready to go when there's a smoke event in a community, especially in communities of color, the BIPOC community, the indigenous community. Those are communities that are mostly affected by this, so we have a huge social injustice that is tied to climate change. And those communities are the ones that are really in the front lines of climate change and are the ones that need the most resources to prepare for what's happening.
You've mentioned some of the diverse effects of climate change across the globe. What are other threats that the Northern Rockies are going to face in response to climate change, for instance, in lowering snowpack?
So anywhere I go in mountainous areas of the West, the snowpack is the lifeline to our clean water system. It's the lifeline to the agricultural economy, to the fisheries economy, to people just growing gardens, right? It's water is our lifeline. And the more we are drought stressed, the more we are sucking too much water out of our aquifers because of overdevelopment, the more that's going to amplify the climate change effect. We got to get better about water conservation. We've got to get better about protecting our wild areas that are delivering our clean water supply, because water is going to be the key issue that makes or breaks the West in the coming decades. The other thing I should mention is that clean water is so vital to communities, and one of the major stressors is road building, because it delivers sediments to the stream and cows in the streams. So we could stop building roads, we could decommission and obliterate roads, we can close roads to limit fire ignitions that we don't want on the landscape, and we can take the cows out of the streams, because water is really going to be the determining factor in the coming decades here.
And going back to road development, one other impact that you mentioned in, you know, rescinding the roadless rule and other just management tactics is fragmentation of wildlife habitat. How can wildlife, as ecosystem engineers, help improve community resiliency if their habitats are preserved?
Oh, yeah, the beaver is a good example of that. You know, we got to bring back the beaver to the streams, because it's the stream architect. It's the architect of slow water. So when you have a beaver dam there, the water's moving through the system in a more functional way, so that it's not just all running out quickly. It's slowed down by that species. It's a keystone riparian obligate that makes habitat for all kinds of wildlife, bird species, amphibians, fish, all depend on beaver. And so if we really want to slow our water down, beavers are a much better dam builder than we are.
How are the Northern Rockies representative of a global phenomena?
So everywhere I go on the planet, I'm seeing very similar challenges, especially in places that have uncontrolled growth. And I can understand it. I mean, I would love to live in the wild areas interface in any one of these Western communities. It's just magnificent to be close to nature. But that comes with a shared responsibility. And our shared responsibility is, okay, I've got this really cool house. I live close to the wild areas, so I need to be responsible and prepare my house. Don't expect the Forest Service or the BLM to do it for me by logging in the backcountry. Do it myself. And at the same time, I need to get involved in protecting those wild areas, because we know that when wildlands are developed, it has a depressing effect on home values. So if you want to resell your home at some point, you don't want to have a clear cut in your backyard that everybody's looking at. You want to have a wild area, right? So it makes economic sense. It makes property value sense to have wild areas in your backyard as your responsibility for being part of that community. So take initiative in loving these places by caring for these places, because we're not getting it out of the governments. So it has to come from the local level. It has to be a grassroots-led initiative that says, these places are so important to me, my home values, my home protection, my clean water, the fish and wildlife that I get from hunting in these places, the recreation, the spirituality, the carbon absorption that helps to regulate my climate are all important to me. And it's why I moved here. And so love and cherish these places, because if we don't, they're going to really vanish at an unprecedented rate, so that the next generation isn't going to have these opportunities.
Amidst amassing pressures on global ecological integrity, rising severity and volatility in political discourse, and policymaking that seems intent on working backwards, what gives you hope?
Young people. I derive my strength from the generation of young activists that are out there in the trenches, working across coalitions, building coalitions with other interests, social justice movements, women's movements, trans pride movements, all of those working together to transform society. It has to come from the young people working with the elders to really get us moving in the right direction again.
What forms of activism have you seen to be successful?
You know, good old-fashioned rallies, and we've seen it over and over again with the No Kings rally. Thousands of people taking the streets. That has to be sustained, and it has to be unified across movements to really get the change that we want. So somewhat going back to the 60s with the mass demonstrations and building on that with an infusion of the youth movement is what we need to turn this thing around. Otherwise, the consequences are going to be increasingly dire, not only for us, but the next generation that has to deal with how we are treating or mistreating the planet right now.
I understand that you're a musician. It's one of the hats that you wear. Has your music impacted your work as a conservationist?
Music is just pure love. It's just a way to bring everybody together. And when I play at my concerts, I make an announcement that my band is all about the love that we have for music and each other. So when you come to our concerts, put aside your political differences and just look at people as people. And let's bring this together and all work on our problems together. And music is one way to kind of stitch everything together in a peaceful way. And it's also a way to get a message across in a way that people can relate to. I mean, you can get social injustice messages through, environmental messages through in music. And especially if you start listening to the lyrics in a lot of popular songs that have a social justice message or an environmental message, we need more of that. And that's what I bring as a musician and a scientist.
There's one more thing I'd like to ask you about. You are currently a senior conservation science associate at the Conservation Biology Institute. A recent newsletter of the organization mentioned your upcoming work on a project called the North American Forest Initiative. Is there anything you'd like to share with the public at this point about this project?
Yeah, so I've been working globally for my 45-year career with a focus on North America. Now, forests all over the globe are important, and I can't work everywhere, so I have zoomed in on North America because we have some of the most important forests on the planet. I'll give you some examples. The coastal rainforests that span a green belt of forest from the redwoods in California all the way up to Alaska, including the Great Bear Rainforest in British Columbia, are amazing ecosystems. The inland forest in British Columbia, which is one of the rarest inland rainforest in the world that extends down into northwest Montana in Glacier National Park, is another area that's really important. The Rocky Mountains have these amazing forests that extend from the Southern Rockies in Colorado all the way up to British Columbia and Alberta. Those forests are magnificent. You go to the eastern United States and you've got the color changes that are happening in Vermont and Maine forests right now. And those forests are important. Or the forest in the Appalachia, the Smoky Mountains, the southeast Florida Panhandle, the longleaf wire grass community that is one of the most exceptional examples of understory biodiversity on the planet. Our forests right here in our backyard are globally significant. And the way we maintain those forests is we love them and we steward them properly and we protect them and we recognize that all the values that we get from those forests are maintained when they are protected from logging, from road building, and from industrial activities. That's what this program is about.
One more question for me. That old saying that you can't see the forest for the trees, what does that mean to you?
I take it one step further. You can't see the forest for the ecosystem. And the trees are the stalwarts in the ecosystem. But forests are much more than trees. They're the sum of their ecosystem parts, which makes them greater than the whole, right? And the whole are all of the interactions, the trophic level interactions in a forest, whether you're a population of red tree voles in the canopy and salamanders living in the moss in the tallest redwood, a micro ecosystem in the canopy going down into the forest understory, in the penthouse, in the soils, the basement, the soils. All of it's connected. It's part of a whole, and it functions when it's all working together. When we start plucking out pieces, the big trees, the soils get impacted, that you start to sever those links. And even though you still might have trees standing there, the functionality of that forest is impacted. So we've got to start looking at forest as a whole, as an interacting, interconnected whole that is an ecosystem. And the way we influence those parts will determine whether that ecosystem continues to give us clean water, clean air, recreation, spirituality, wildlife benefits, and even protection from fires. Because as we talked about, they don't burn as intensely on average as the roaded, logged landscapes do. So we need them as a buffer from intense fires. We'll end with this. In many ways, my career started in the Yellowstone to Yukon area in the early 1990s. So it was really special for me to be back here full circle and realize the work that has been going on from grassroots activists like GWA and like a lot of the other organizations that are working to protect the Northern Rockies is intergenerational. And I'm really pleased that that's continuing to happen. And I hope we see an infusion of young people that are picking up the baton and continuing this rally race, this relay race to protect these areas cross-generational.
We'd like to thank Dr. Della Sala for visiting us here in Bozeman and sharing his insights. The ecological issues associated with current and proposed forest management practices can be seen in the wildlands that make up our own backyards. The GWA has long carried the goal of securing wilderness designation for the Gallatin Range. Recent legislative activity, like the proposed rescission of the roadless rule, are in direct opposition to these goals of preserving the landscape. There are also localized projects throughout our region that are microcosms of this wider trend in forest management. One within our neighborhood is the Whitetail State Creek Project in the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest. One of the stated resource objectives of this project is to respond to Presidential Order 14225, Immediate Expansion of American Timber Production. The project area is proposed to span over 39,000 acres, 1,190 of which would receive commercial vegetation treatment. Written comments will be accepted for this project through September 28th. For anyone who couldn't make it in person, a recording of Dr. Della Sala's presentation back on September 12th will soon be available on the Gallatin Wildlife Association's YouTube page. Since we have a bit of time left, I'll close us out with an excerpt from that presentation that I personally feel ties some key ideas together. Here's that clip now.
I have three articles that are in different stages that are coming out soon. The first that should be out in a couple of weeks is the one I kind of alluded to it. Dead trees are not the fast fire problem. And we are publishing that in the National Academy of Sciences with a whole bunch of other scientists around the globe. Examples of fires not burning intensely when there's no canopy, and yet the dead trees are targeted all the time. So that's one myth. The second one is the cost of thinning. All we hear about, benefit, benefit, benefit. What about the cost, right? And if you're doing a spreadsheet and you've got a checking account, you want to know what's in your checking account, balance, what you're taking out, what you're putting in. You don't want to just look at one part of the ledger and say, oh yeah, I just got benefits, and not pay attention to how you're taking it out. You got to look at both sides, right? And when you do that weighting analysis, the costs are really significant to ecosystems and type shifts, to savannas, to actually increasing the understory vegetation, because now you got all this light coming in and you're releasing all those shrubs and you've got soil impacts and carbon impacts and sedimentation problems and invasive species. And you never hear the agencies talk about that. They think they could mitigate everything, and that's hubris, because we can't. And we don't have the energy, the time, the money to properly mitigate all these impacts. There are costs involved. it's something like $2,000 to $4,000 an acre to thin a site, depending on a lot of the factors involved and access, et cetera. So there's cost there financially too. And is it really doing the job? Some places it is, but overall, I argue it's taking us in the opposite direction. The third paper that we're working on, which I think will be out, it's not a science paper, it's an opinion piece, in the Revelator in the next couple of weeks, is the do loop of using the same approach that caused the problem to fix the problem. Right? I hear this all the time, too. I've been in congressional hearings where the timber industry representative next to me is claiming they're not in the business of logging forest anymore. They're in the business of saving the spotted owl from a fire burning down the forest. And I'm there scratching my head. Wait a minute. I was on the owl recovery team. And that's not right. But that's the do loop. We caused the problem by logging, and now the solution is logging. We're just going to package it differently. We're going to say, hey, if we log this forest, we won't get the fires that are pushing the owl out. But we did a study of the northern spotted owl, the only paper that was ever published in 2024. Monica Bond led this. We looked at all of the data on northern spotted owl nest site abandonment. Every single owl territory, and there were like 110 that we had good data on, had logging before and after fire. Most of the territories had multiple logging entries and barred owl invasion. Guess what gets blamed for nest site abandonment? Fire. Not the logging before and after, and not the encroachment that was enabled by the logging of the barred owl. Do loop. We caused the problem, we fixed the problem with the same thing. Now, it's different. It's not entirely the same. We're not talking about big clear cuts of the 1960s, but we're talking about taking out big trees, over-ventilating the forest, so you lose that wind buffering effect that you get with intact canopies. In extreme fire weather, it's going to blow through. You might have some victories in low to moderate intensity burning if you're doing sub-canopy thinning and you're removing the fuels that you've caused, but you got a cost, right? And that cost goes up depending on how much you take out and what you take out. That's the conversation you need to have at the agencies. Yeah, yeah, benefit, benefit, benefit. But what about this part of the ledger, and how are you dealing with it? Cumulative effects, cumulative disturbance burden. NEPA allows for cumulative effects. If we still even have NEPA, I don't know. Everything is a categorical exclusion now. Okay, I'm really bumming myself out. My faith is in the organizations working in the trenches. GWA, so some other groups out there. You guys are the heroes. You're the ones that can slow it down. You're the ones that can stop it, working with the scientists, working in the courts, working with the public. I know it's hard. I know it's frustrating. There are more losses than there are victories. But without you guys, it would be a hell of a lot worse. So much worse. The wildlands that we enjoy today are because people like yourselves have been putting in years of dedicated conservation service. So I don't want to bum you all out, and because I get bummed out about it too, which is why I play music. Keep doing what you're doing. Don't give up. There's still hope. And if we don't have hope, nothing changes. So I think I'll leave you with that.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found at its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.